Okay, well, we're still Judge Bea, Judge Callahan, and Judge Bumate, so we're back, and I'm going to call the matter of Oceana Inc. versus National Marine Fisheries Services at Sea Processors Association. Each side has 20 minutes, and I see, as I stated previously, appellees are splitting time, that NIMS will take 17 minutes, and is it at sea will take 3 minutes, is that correct?
We're going to do 16 and 4, but yeah.
Oh, you've changed up. Okay, well, okay. I can be flexible. I was a trial judge a long time ago, so okay, well, then the case number 25-7689, we're ready to proceed. Good morning.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Kate Glover, and with my colleague Andrea Treese, I represent the appellant Oceana, who has representatives here in the courtroom. I'd aspirationally like to reserve 5 minutes of my time for rebuttal. The parties agree on or do not dispute many of the important issues in this case, and all the court needs to decide is a straightforward legal question. Can the Fisheries Service meet its obligation to minimize all adverse effects on all designated essential fish habitat by considering only two tests, using only two tests to identify those adverse effects? Those are the core essential fish habitat test and MSST, or overfished thresholds. The answer is no. The core essential fish habitat test fails because it does not consider all of the designated habitat, and the MSST test fails because it only identifies severe effects that cause a population to crash, not any adverse fishing effects. These are the only two required tests in the Fisheries Service's process, and they're both unlawful, alone or in combination, because neither test cures the flaws of the other. I'll focus today on these two tests.
Do you mind starting with the jurisdictional argument? What is the nature of your Article III standing?
Sure. We have standing because...
I didn't hear how much time you want to save for rebuttal.
Oh, 5 minutes. I'm sorry.
Thank you.
Yes, with respect to standing, we have standing because Oceana and its members use areas of essential fish habitat that have been designated essential fish habitat for fishing, for watching wildlife, for viewing the coral and sponge gardens that are at issue here that are damaged by fishing, and continue.
So that's the injury is bottom trolling, essentially destroying the habitat?
That would be the main form of fishing, but there's damage from other forms of fishing too. So that's correct. That's the form of fishing.
That's the injury, the bottom troll. Now, are you alleging that there's overfishing?
No, we're not alleging that there's overfishing. That's not...
Yeah, so I guess that's my confusion. Then what's the injury here? If you're saying it's the right amount of fishing, how are you being injured?
The fishing itself, the fishing techniques damage the habitat, and that affects the fish that are available.
So any amount of fishing, in your view, leads to an Article III injury for you?
It can, and that's a form... That chain of causation is something that Congress recognizes in the Magnuson-Stevens Act. It adopted the essential fish habitat provisions because it recognized that fishing, among other things, can destroy habitat, and that in turn harms the fish populations, and that harms the fisheries and the ecosystem that depend on that habitat.
So any amount of fishing, in your view, leads to injury, correct?
I think that's right, and there's evidence in the record that shows that the first pass of a trawl does the most damage.
Okay. Okay, so then now you have to prove, causation redressability. So how is these amendments lead to your injury?
The amendments the action that's at issue here is the adoption of amendments that don't comply with the obligations of the Magnuson-Stevens Act. Had the Fisheries Service met its obligations, it might have identified adverse fishing effects and then taken action to practically minimize them.
Right. So, that's pretty speculative, though, right?
You're
saying might have recognized something.
Let me correct that. If there are adverse fishing effects under the Magnuson-Stevens Act, the Fisheries Service has an obligation to take practicable measures to minimize those effects.
So it's a summary judgment.
Yes.
Okay, so that means, though, you have to put some evidence in a summary judgment of your standing, right? And so let's assume you get past the injury part, but What evidence do you have, is there in the record that the injuries are or would be sufficiently, which is another way of asking what Judge Bumate has said, traceable to the FMP amendments?
The court has recognized that traceability, there can be multiple steps in a chain of causation, and the question is how plausible those steps are. So the
agree that at summary judgment you have to put some evidence of that?
Yes, and we have declarations in the record showing the harms that occur from fishing and the uses that plaintiffs and that Oceana's members have for essential fish habitat. And the harm, I think there's, even in the federal brief, recognizes the ways that fishing can harm habitat.
That's the injury part. What's the traceability?
I think the chain is that the essential fish habitat is the habitat that is necessary for fish. Oceana's members use those fish. They fish for them. They feed their families. Fishing harms that habitat and reduces fish populations, as well as damages the ecosystem. And that makes it so that Oceana's members are not able to fish for the fish commercially, for subsistence, recreationally. They're not able to enjoy the coral gardens, which they've attested to seeing the difference
between. I'm still
between.
Not seeing it being traceable to the amendments here.
One thing that I guess I'd like to point out is that we've alleged that the amendments are not in compliance with the law. And if the court were to find here.
That's a statutory question. We're talking purely Article 3 jurisdiction.
Yes. And for purposes of Article 3 jurisdiction, the court assumes that the plaintiffs.
There's a violation. I agree.
Yeah. So I think that if the court were to find here that there's no standing because the amendments the Fisheries Service actually adopted don't do very much, then the result would be that you might be able to establish standing when the Fisheries Service does what it's supposed to do. It finds the adverse effects and it takes action to minimize them. But it would be, but you couldn't challenge it when the Fisheries Service fails to comply with their obligations and doesn't adopt practicable minimization measures. And so I think that's the important thing to focus on is what we've alleged they should have done.
The problem I'm seeing is the whole point is there has to be adverse effects, right? But you're not alleging that there is an adverse effect. You're saying if they adopt the right amendments, then they might discover an adverse effect, which then makes it traceable to your injury.
As an example, in page, I think it's page 44 of our opening brief, we've provided the maps that show where fishing is happening that is not being considered under their analysis.
Right.
And it's happening where there's corals and sponges and other things that have been identified as important habitat for those species. So that's the type of adverse effect that isn't being identified that should be under a proper analysis.
I get it, but don't you have to allege that there is an actual adverse effect? You're just saying, like, because they're not doing the right analysis, that they might be missing an adverse effect, correct?
Yes, and one of the declarations from Oceana's members describes going down to see or photographing and seeing visibly the corals and sponges in an area that has been fished and an area that hasn't been fished. Another, a lifelong Alaskan, talks about how much harder it's gotten to fish in the time that he's been fishing for these areas.
But, I mean, even if they were to adopt what you would consider, you know, an analysis that is compliant with the law, they might not find any adverse effect, and so there'd be no change in the amount of fishing, correct? That's a possibility.
That is a possibility.
Right. So I guess this is why, to me, this is all speculative.
I'd also point the court to, if I can find the citation to the case, but the court has recognized that redressability is not defeated simply because an agency may come to a different decision for different reasons after a remand. And I think that's the case here. It is quite possible that they could do another analysis and decide that there aren't any adverse effects. But I would submit that, as we've shown in our briefs, there are adverse effects that are happening in areas that are not being considered.
Wait, so you are alleging adverse effects?
Yes, I think the maps that I pointed to in the brief show those adverse effects that are happening outside. There's trawling happening there in areas that have corals and sponges, and the agency itself recognizes that trawling can damage that.
It's not just the fact that there's trawling, right? There has to be over-trawling or something like that, right?
No, and I think that's important to this case. It doesn't have to be that too many fish are being caught to harm habitat. The provisions here are about protecting habitat, both for fishing and for the ecosystem.
Are you saying that anytime there's trawling, there's injury and it's connected and you've shown traceability. That's what I just heard you say.
Well, the evidence shows that anytime a trawl net is dragged across the ocean floor, it damages coral and sponges and other habitat. And that doesn't have to have population level effects on the fish in order to cause harm to the habitat. These provisions were adopted because Congress recognized that one of the greatest threats to the nation's fisheries was the harming habitat. And so that's the focus here, is the habitat that's been harmed, which in turn affects the ability of Oceana's members to be able to fish and engage in recreational activities in these areas.
Okay, but that I understood. So harming the habitat is separate from harming the habitat causing less fish. Because those could be two different things, right?
Yes, they could. And Congress, I think, recognized that by not setting a requirement that harm to habitat has to have population level effects. So any damage to the head, and I think I want to say it's the Boilie Declaration that talks about observing the coral and sponge gardens. And so damage to those in and of itself can be a harm.
So isn't your challenge here really that the amendments do not prescribe certain mitigation measures that you would like to see implemented?
Yes, I think that's correct.
So you argue that the FMP amendments are unlawful because they resulted from an unlawful method of evaluating adverse effects on the EFH. Wouldn't you agree that neither the MSA nor agency regulations direct the agency to use any specific method of evaluating adverse effects on the EFH?
That's correct. The agency can decide how it does the evaluation, but it has to comply with the boundaries that are provided in the law. The law provides the minimum bounds, and we are arguing that what the agency here did does not comply with that minimum bar.
So I think the agency argues that the amendments are non-regulatory actions that prescribe information to be used in any future implementation decision. Is that your view? In your view, what is the legal effect of the amendments?
Well, again, what's challenged is their failure to do what they should have done, and so the amendments could do more. But in American Oceans Campaign v. Daly, the district court in D.C. looked at very similar amendments that updated information without adopting measures and found that those were reviewable and that there was standing there. And the reason is because those amendments apply to a number of fisheries, they have future effect, and they are final actions. The future effect, this does describe and identify the areas of essential fish habitat that the agency will look at, for example, when it has consultations with other agencies about non-fishing activities. They're also the basis for the evaluation here of whether or not there are fishing effects and what needs to be done about that.
So hypothetically, and I'm saying hypothetically, I know you don't agree, if we were to find that you don't have standing, that you haven't satisfied the traceability and that it's too speculative, this would be dismissed. Does that, then you can challenge it later when you have that information, right?
The Fisheries Service hasn't pointed to any future implementation decision when we would be able to challenge it that would change things here, because there isn't going to be a follow-up step where they go back and say, oh, maybe we should have adopted these measures to protect this area. There won't be a future step when it would provide more information relevant for the court's assessment of the process.
Well, wouldn't there be a point in the future, if this were to occur, that there could be, that they are not minimizing adverse effects, and then therefore that would give you standing and traceability?
You mean if several years down the line we were to send a boat out there and say, look at all this damage that has occurred from the fishing, but there isn't a new action that's been taken at that point?
I don't know. I mean, to me, it seems that at a minimum, you have to say that the government's policies have led to an adverse effect, and that they're not complying with their duty to minimize adverse effects. And I just don't see that here. You haven't alleged that yet.
I think you can see that in the declaration that describes seeing areas that have been fished right. in essential fish habitat and but, areas but, that haven't.
Yeah, but that just means that there was some damage. But, you know, adverse effects is a legal term of art, right? It's not necessarily.
And it's any impact that affects the quality or quantity of essential fish habitat.
That's so more than
pretty
minimal
low bar.
And not temporary in nature, right? So even if we saw the danger to this damage to the sponge, it could grow back in a couple of weeks.
Most sponges take much longer than that, and coral can take hundreds of years to grow back.
Know, but
so
some
it's not
grow
a short
really
term.
Fast too, so. See, that's my point. None of this is in the record for us to know any of that.
I don't think the court needs to decide whether there is long-term permanent harm to essential fish habitat in order to find that they're standing here. It simply needs to find that there is a plausible chain of causation.
Yeah. I know. I guess to me, the best way for you to get your Article III standing is allege that there's actual adverse effects that the government is not properly managing. And once you have that, then maybe we could figure out a chain of causation. But without that one step, I don't see how you have standing here.
I'd point out that Congress intended these to be precautionary and to address the damage before it becomes too late. And that's where we are here. There's been ongoing harm, ongoing damage from fishing happening in areas designated as essential fish habitat. And that is already affecting Oceana's members because it does reduce the viability of that habitat for their activities and for fish.
If you could do the merits argument real quick, I'd love to hear why you think the core idea doesn't make sense to me. You know, there is a plausible reasoning for why you're focusing on the core area, right?
Yep. Yeah. Starting with the plain language of the statute, it says it requires that the Fisheries Service in its fishery management plans describe and identify essential fish habitat and minimize to the extent practicable adverse effects on such habitat caused by fishing. That's simple and unambiguous, and in the second clause, such habitat refers back to the designated habitat in the first clause. So it requires the Fisheries Service to examine the fishing effects on the habitat that it has designated under the fishery management plan. The only qualifier in that statute is practicable, and that applies to the minimization measures, not to the essential fish habitat that's designated or the degree of adversity of the fishing effects, only to what measures are later adopted. There's three steps that it anticipates. It's identifying and designating the habitat, evaluating the effects on that habitat, and then minimizing. And it's only the second one that's at issue here, whether they properly evaluated it.
Are you arguing the agency violated specific agency regulations promulgated under the MSA?
No, we're arguing that it violated the statute. And in fact, the regulations here support the plain language of the statute. They define adverse effects to be any impact on the quality or quantity of habitat. And specifically with respect to core effects or core EFH, the regulations require an evaluation of potential adverse effects of fishing on EFH designated under the fishery management plan.
Well, but it seems to me in your original complaint, you claimed that the challenged FMP amendments were inconsistent with the MSA, were arbitrary and capricious under the APA, and violated NEPA. On appeal, you argue only that the Fishery Service's method of evaluating adverse effects was inconsistent with the MSA. What specific text in the MSA supports your claim that the agency's method of evaluation was unlawful? Do you believe that this text requires the agency to use a specific evaluation measures for adverse effects on EFH?
With respect to the core essential fish habitat test, the language is where it says such habitat, which refers back to the essential fish habitat designated by the agency. The discretion the agency has is in deciding what habitat to designate, but once it's designated that habitat, it has to consider all of it. The Magnuson-Stevens Act doesn't allow it to then decide that maybe it wasn't really so essential after all, unless it goes back and reconsiders that decision about what habitat is essential. With respect to the MSST argument, the language is adverse effects. It requires minimization of all adverse effects caused by fishing, and the regulations have even stronger language about that. that require minimizing to the extent practicable, any impact that reduces quality or quantity of EFH, and then require an evaluation of fishing effects to minimize any adverse effects from fishing to the extent practicable.
Do you believe that that text requires the agency to use a specific evaluation measure to do that?
No, I think the agency has the authority to decide what measure it uses to evaluate that, and the court doesn't need to direct them to follow a specific model or process. All it needs to decide is the legal question of whether they can take the shortcut they're taking and only look at half of the habitat and some of the adverse effects, rather than meeting the terms of the statute to evaluate all of it.
Any additional questions? All right. Basically, we've taken up most of your time. So I'm going to add, you still have like 20. I'm going to give you 3.5 minutes for a rebuttal.
Okay. Thank you.
Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. Amy Collier on behalf of the National Marine Fisheries Service. As I mentioned, I plan to take 16 minutes and leave 4 minutes for intervenors counsel. I'd like to start with the jurisdictional question because that's where the court started. I think the issue that we're having here is that Oceana's claimed injury is from this quote unquote continued trawling in this area. But the actual agency action that they're challenging are these minor amendments to the fishery management plan that don't authorize any continued trawling and instead are non-regulatory efforts to update the essential fish habitat information and update maps and information about that.
What do you mean by non-regulatory?
So if the amendments to the fishery management plan had some sort of, like, weren't these minor amendments that were adjusting the maps and stuff, had some sort of regulatory effect, NIMS would have to go through a notice and comment period to adopt them by regulation. And that did not happen here because they didn't have those sort of changes to the management that warranted
regulation. So it was regulation. Just what was the procedure for adopting these amendments then?
So it went, the council recommended these changes. NIMS published notice of it in the federal record. There was an environmental assessment under NEPA evaluating, addressing those changes, and then NIMS adopted those changes to the fishery management plan.
Isn't that the same as formal rulemaking, or what's the...
So the rulemaking process would require a notice and comment period, there was not a notice and comment period, my understanding, in the same sense as if there were that regulatory changes.
Well, it sort of looked like the district court kind of just jumped over standing. But I noticed in your brief at footnote 5, you contend that Oceana's claims are not yet ripe. Do you see the issue before us more as a ripeness issue or as a standing issue?
I think it's a little bit of both. I think our primary argument is this causation and redressability concern. But I think there's also this piece that there isn't some new regulatory action that has already happened based on these amendments that Oceana is challenging. So that's the ripeness piece. I think the causation and redressability really comes from the Supreme Court's cases in Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance and the two Lujan cases, where the court really pushed back on attempts to use the APA process to challenge a wholesale programmatic attack on what the agency is doing. So NIMS does a lot of things. It regulates a lot of things. It does have...
Are you conceding then they have step one, that there is an injury?
I think that they have shown that they could plausibly be injured in some way by trawling on the ocean floor. I don't know if there's that level of specificity that... They haven't identified any adverse impacts that NIMS needed to address and didn't address, and that those particular impacts would impact Oceana's members. I think in the abstract, yes, their members have alleged that they use those areas and they have an abstract injury. But in terms of a concrete injury connected to this action, I think that's where it's lacking.
So if we said, hypothetically, that they don't have standing and we dismiss this, what can they do in the future? If we say you haven't shown anything traceable, it's too speculative, blah blah blah, they what can they do in the future?
So I think it's important, again, to understand the context of what NMFS is doing here. This is a regular five-year update to the essential fish habitat information. NMFS is already in the process of doing the next one, and Oceana is participating in that process. It's an open process. All the council meetings are public. People can participate in it, and that's happening right now. I think if they become aware of adverse impacts that they've identified or the agency has identified that the agency is not minimizing as it could practically, and they can point to how those, that sort of lack of action is impacting them, I think arguably there they could have standing. I just think on this record here, we haven't established that.
I'm sorry, are you aware last week we had an en banc case with Arizona Alliance? Has that affected the, I don't know if you've analyzed it yet, has that affected?
I have read it. I don't think so, because I think that's more of the diversion of resources piece, and that hasn't been alleged here by Oceana. So I think, you know, another point, just looking at the relief that Oceana is seeking to, if you look at the remedy, they're not asking for vacatur. They're saying they concede that these minor amendments actually don't cause environmental harm. They don't want them vacated. They want the court to, again, take this programmatic approach to dictate how the agency does future analyses and future actions. And that's just the sort of thing that the Supreme Court has been very clear.
We believe the amendments are unlawful because the agency failed to consider all of the relevant data. Wouldn't that go to Oceana's original arbitrary and capricious claim, which Oceana forfeited?
Which claim that they forfeited? That they ignored certain evidence that the agency should. Yeah, so I think, again, Oceana didn't advance that point on appeal. I think on appeal, they're really just focusing on what methodology the agency used to make this determination, again, in this five-year update, as to whether there are adverse effects that are more than minimal and not temporary that should be practicably addressed. And
is there any text in the MSA or applicable regulations that directs the agency to use any specific method of evaluation when conducting its assessment for adverse effects on EFH?
No, there's not. The MSA itself is very broad. It directs, this is 16 U.S.C. 1853A7, it directs the agency to describe and identify EFH based on guidelines established by the service to minimize to the extent practicable adverse effects on such habitat. Both of those pieces, directing the service to adopt guidelines, which again is reiterated in 1855B, both of those provisions, that and then the to extent practicable, give the agency a lot of discretion in determining when to act to minimize those adverse effects. Now, we agree that there is a requirement that you need to describe and identify EFH. No dispute that the agency did that here. It has maps for every single species of EFH. And also, in terms of identifying and evaluating adverse effects, I think one thing that Oceana is skipping over is the whole fishing effects model that the agency has developed. And this is something that over the last three EFH reviews, the agency has really improved and honed this model. This model takes data about fishing activity, where the fishing is occurring, what type of fishing activity is occurring, what type of habitat is found there, how quickly that habitat recovers, how susceptible it is to the fishing activity, puts all of this data into a model, and then produces a map showing cumulative estimates of habitat disturbance across the entire region. That's not limited to just the core EFH area. The agency is looking broadly at those impacts. Where the core EFH area and the MSST come in is in evaluating whether any of those effects are having more than minimal adverse impacts or more than temporary ones, and whether the agency needs to act. And so, again, in this five-year review, the question is whether they're looking at the new scientific information that's available, that's in the guidelines, that's sort of the only guidance that the agency has for this five-year review, is to look at, should include published scientific literature and unpublished scientific reports, soliciting info, searching for previously unavailable data. That's the limits of it.
So when you're saying you're limiting the review to the core essential fish habitat, is that because you think that the government thinks that that will minimize to the extent practicable, or is there another reason why you're limiting it to that
So 2 points on that. I would push back to say the agency's not limiting that. I think it's clear in the description of what the SOC assessment authors were asked to do that that is a parameter that they want the SOC assessment authors to look at, but that doesn't preclude them from looking beyond that area. So just as a baseline to that. But yes, I think the agency explained why it was reasonable to focus on the area where the species is most often found to evaluate whether there are adverse effects that are more than minimal and not temporary. Now, again, the definition in the regulations of minimal impacts are may result in relatively small changes in the infected environment and insignificant changes in ecological function. So again, it's looking at what are those impacts to the species, and they're focusing on that particular area. And again, the agency explained why it chose that 50% rather than a smaller area or a larger area. That's at 3 ER 385, I think. And it explained that, you know, if we look at a smaller area, we might miss important habitat areas. If we look at a larger area, we might dilute the impacts and miss important impacts to important areas that the species uses.
Can you explain that part? So if you're looking at 100% of the area, you're going to run out of resources to make sure that you actually are catching it. Is that the argument?
I think that's part of it. I mean, again, this is, you know, evaluating impacts largely on the seafloor. You can't just go out and look at them. You have to sort of make assumptions, look at the data you have, and evaluate on a high level across a huge area. So I think that's part of it. But I think it's also that if you're looking at, you know, 100% of the area and you're saying, okay, is more than 10% of that affected? Well, it could be all the parts that affected is in the area that the species uses the most, but it doesn't reach that 10% threshold. And so it's sort of diluting where the most important impacts to the species are. So again, I think the statute doesn't preclude the agency from drawing those sorts of lines. I think also just to step back to Loper Bright was very clear that there are statutes that direct the agency to exercise its discretion and ask the agency, Congress wants the agency to sort of fill up those details of the scheme. Congress did that by asking the agency, directing the agency to do those guidelines, and then also by minimizing to the extent practicable. And I think that's exactly the situation we have here. I think the First Circuit in the Conservation Law Foundation, you know, evaluated, interpreted that to the extent practicable language and came to that same conclusion. I don't think we got to the minimum stock size threshold in Oceana's opening, but I did just want to briefly push back on a couple of things that they raised in their briefing that the service is precluded from considering the effects to the population. So again, the service is coming at this looking at the species at a population level, and it's done this since 2005. It's looked at whether the species is above or below this threshold in doing so. And I don't think there's anything unreasonable about that. Congress recognized in the definition of essential fish habitat that there's a connection between the habitat itself and the species. So what are the waters in the substrate that are necessary for the species for these various growth stages? And so it's reasonable at this threshold level to consider, you know, as part of the larger analysis, what is the status of the species? Are there impacts that could be caused by habitat impacts that we need to address? And so again, part of the larger analysis, the agency thoroughly explained why it considered those pieces. And I think that covered all of my points, unless the court has any further questions.
We don't seem to.
Okay, so
a little bit of time on the clock, so if your colleague wants to take a little longer.
Sure, and I just would try to remind the court again, you know, the stage that we're in with the regular updates. The agency has already started the next update. It each time is looking for ways to improve this process, and it's doing that again in the process that's going on right now. And so I think the challenge here is if there's some issue with the method that the agency is using, you know, the solution is not to dictate a new method that might prevent the agency from already improving what it's trying to do, and to let the experts really look at the data, look at the methodology, and select the best process. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. James Feldman on behalf of the intervener defendant appellees, and may it please the court, interveners would like to briefly address two issues this morning. First, whether the service's choice of metrics to assess phishing effects presents a technical question of science as opposed to a question of statutory interpretation. And second, whether the service's consideration of the minimum stock size threshold and core EFH area metrics is rationally related to an assessment of phishing effects on habitat.
You don't have a strong position on this Article III standing issue.
The interveners agree with all the arguments that the federal defendants have made, Your Honor. The Magnuson-Stevens Act directs the service to minimize, to the extent practicable, adverse effects on essential habitat caused by fishing. These words, to the extent practicable, is the statutory language by which Congress gave the service discretion to assess adverse effects. Congress did not and could not have prescribed the exact metrics by which adverse effects are evaluated in all settings. That determination necessarily requires a weighing of the tools and the science that are available to the agency, as well as the practicality of applying them to a particular fishery. Both the First Circuit and the D.C. District Court in multiple cases concluded that Congress entrusted this determination to the service's discretion. That's because the service has the technical and the scientific expertise to determine what is practicable when it comes to minimizing adverse effects. And interveners are aware of no court that has reached a contrary conclusion. This appeal does not present a question of what this statutory language means. It presents a challenge to the service's scientific judgments. This court consistently extends its highest degree of judicial deference, whereas here it is reviewing an agency's technical expertise and analyses and judgments involving complex scientific data. Now, turning to those metrics, Oceana has a tough burden here. This court rejects an agency's choice of scientific model only when it bears no rational relationship to the characteristics of the data to which it is applied. Minimum stock size has reliably been used by the service for over 20 years to assess habitat impacts. And that's because downward trends in minimum stock size provide valuable information about habitat disturbances long before a species approaches its minimum level. The service also explained the scientific utility of the core EFH area metric. The consideration of core EFH does not mean that the service ignored impacts to half of a species' essential fish habitat. The service used its sophisticated fishing effects model, as you just heard from the government, to look at impacts to all essential fish habitat. The service also considered core EFH, and for good reason. Core EFH is a more sensitive metric to habitat disturbance than using a species' entire essential fish habitat. And it effectively lowers the threshold of habitat disturbance that would elevate a species for consideration of mitigation measures. So the service has explained the utility and the scientific value of minimum stock size and core EFH in evaluating habitat impacts.
So I think it's your position that Oceana's claim on appeal is in reality an arbitrary and capricious claim, right?
That's correct.
But given that Oceana expressly waived that complaint, do we even need to assess the rationality of the agency's evaluation?
Well, I think a belt and suspenders approach is appropriate here to address the merits of their claim, you know, determining how the court comes down on your first question.
Well, even if we reach the merits, wouldn't it be enough for us to conclude that the agency's evaluation of adverse effects on EFH did not violate the MSA or agency regulations and leave it at that?
I think that would be enough, Your Honor.
Okay.
So, and I think something that's extremely...
But belt and suspenders... I don't really like to assume jurisdiction. We're very zealous in federal court about jurisdiction. So assuming jurisdiction, and then that's what you're saying.
Correct,
you
Your Honor.
Say there is no jurisdiction. But then anyway,
that's right,
if
Your
there
Honor.
Were, you lose. That's
Correct.
What you're saying?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
And tellingly, despite being asked multiple times by the district court, Oceana could not identify a single superior metric that it believes the agency should have used instead. I see my time's almost up, or at least the 4 minutes that were,
a little extra
were originally.
You can use it since your okay. colleague didn't use all her time.
So I'll just conclude by noting that the interveners, they have an interest in sustainable fisheries managed according to the best available science. That is precisely what the service did here with its fishing effects analysis. And the agency's reasoned scientific judgments are entitled to deference. And for those reasons, the interveners would respectfully request that the court affirm the district court's decision below. And unless your honors have any questions.
We don't appear to.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. Well, I gave you a little extra time, and I can't give you their extra time. That would go beyond the
try to be quick.
Beyond fair parenting, I guess, in terms of giving each other extra time. But go ahead.
Certainly. I want to first address the fishing effects model that the Fisheries Service brought up. And in the briefs, there's general agreement among all the parties that the required steps of the process are, first, evaluate MSST, second, look at core central fish habitat, and only if one of those are triggered is any further analysis required. The additional maps of fishing tracks across the whole area are in that discretionary category. If an analyst decides that they feel it's appropriate to consider more, they can choose to do so and decide how to do that. But the language of the statute is a shall, it's not a may, and an agency can't meet its mandatory obligation to do something by giving its analysts the option to decide that they would like to comply with the law. It has to create a process that requires that. Jumping into the MSST, the regulations and the preamble to the regulations are clear that the agency's understanding at the time it adopted the regulations was that Congress did not think it appropriate to require proof of a decline in a fish stocks population, fish productivity, before any action was taken to minimize adverse effects. So it's a really low bar, and the agency explained that what that minimal and temporary language meant was simply not inconsequential effects. But all adverse effects that are not inconsequential do have to be minimized, and at that point the agency has discretion to decide how to do that practicably, but that's not at issue here. With respect to core essential fish habitat, I think the agency has largely pointed back to its argument that looking at all of the habitat, doing what Congress intended it to do, with the language such EFH, consider the habitat designated in the EFH, is that it would dilute the effects in that core area. So the explanation assumes that they're okay to only focus on that core area, what they are calling the most important or most suitable of the essential habitat. Where they exercise that discretion lawfully under the regs is in the statute would be in designating the habitat, not in deciding that some of it is really unessential essential habitat. So if evaluating all of the habitat would dilute the effects in the core area, there's a number of ways they could address that, and those are described in the record in Oceana's comments as well as elsewhere. They could change the percentage to recognize the larger area they're looking at, or they could address effects where they find them rather than averaging them out over a larger area, or look at particular types of habitat that are important. The court doesn't need to decide what process the agency should follow. It just needs to decide what the plain language of the statute requires. Finally, on standing, the court's case precedent is clear that the action that's challenged doesn't have to be the sole cause, even if ongoing actions like fishing are a contributing factor, and that's recognized in Idaho Conservation League, that can be an injury even if some of the action is already happening. The practical effect here is that because the agency is applying constrained metrics, it's not minimizing effects because it's not looking for them, it's not finding them. And that's how that's the redressability. I think there's a difference between what we're arguing with respect to relief and standing. Relief, for purposes of relief, the court looks at what's the fix to this problem. And in that case, it makes sense to leave this action in place. And for purposes of standing, we're looking at assuming that plaintiffs or that appellants are right, is there a redressable injury? I see, I'm out of time, so thank you very much.
For your argument in this matter, very helpful. All right, this court will be in recess until Wednesday at 9 a.m. We have a number of cases that were set for tomorrow, but they've been submitted on the briefs. So have a good afternoon, everyone. Thank you.